Today on The Grave Talks, Darker Than You Ever Imagined, a conversation with Nathaniel Gillis. Nathaniel Gillis started life in a haunted house, a house that held a demonic entity, though. At first, it seemed to be an innocent little girl. He quickly realized that this was something much darker. Nathaniel has then dedicated his life to researching and finding out who, why, and just what is going on with these occurrences that he experienced as a child, and why are they going on today for others in other homes all over the world. His findings have been far darker than anyone could have ever conceived of. Today we discuss his story on The Grave Talks.
It started when I was 8 years old, when I first encountered a full-bodied apparition. I was living in a haunted house at the time, and I had nightmares. I had shadow figures that were looking at me in the middle of the night. And so that was my very first, confrontation with the phenomenon. And that's where I first got my interest.
So tell me a little bit more about that experience. How did that transpire? What was the scene?
So it first started out at the actual open house prior to us moving into the home. My dad took me by the hand as an 8-year-old boy, and he led me into what would become my future room. And he said, take a look around, figure out where you're going to put your bed and your gaming system. Your mother and I are going to be in the kitchen talking to the realtor. And so there I was looking around the room. And one thing that really stuck with me is that even just being in the room, it smelled like something had died there. Like, Dr. Barry Taft would call it rotting or, decomposition.
The welcoming aroma. It's the new house smell, like new car smell. But with homes, it's death.
Yes, sir. It was not very appetizing to me. But it was so unique, it wasn't something that was like organic. To this day, I think it was something that was spiritual.
Yeah.
It was something in that room. And so I'm looking around trying to figure out where everything's going to go. And I felt led. And to this day, I don't know why. I've done hundreds of shows, Tony, and I can't figure out why. But I felt led to crawl on my hands and knees and look underneath the bed that was in the corner of the room. And when I did, I was met face to face with a full-bodied apparition of a little girl. She was about 2 years younger than I was. She had pale complexion, long black hair, and was wearing a white linen dress that looked to have been made during the turn of the century. And I could still remember just both of us shrieking because it was very strange, but she freaked out. And she shimmied her little body to the wall to where we were both the furthest away from each other.
Yeah.
That was an apparition. I learned that later on. That girl did not belong in the house. That girl did not belong in the street. We never saw her again. And so that was when I met the phenomenon face to face. Once we actually moved into the home itself, the entity mutated to where... in the middle of the night, I would hear it displacing its physicality, which is weird because that's not supposed to happen. Displacing its physicality on our wooden floors to where you could hear it creaking its way all the way up to my door.
Yeah.
And then there would be a smoky apparition that would kind of bleed its way through the crack of the door and form into a black cloud hovering in the room. And so I grew up with that. I grew up around it. I went to school with it, And so it sort of built an immunity to the phenomenon within me. I had to, mobilize a coping mechanism around it. It never left.
Uh-huh.
And so that's my introduction to this phenomenon. And that's what I'm all about. I'm trying to understand its pathology, its victimology, and why it targeted me at such a young age.
So how did that go the first day you're in there? You go back down to the kitchen. Hey, Dad, I think I found where I want to put my gaming system. Right next to the creepy little girl that appeared in the room. I mean, how did that, did you tell them right away or how did that go?
Yeah. So initially after the open house, we were in the car driving home and I asked my dad, I said, does the family have any children at all? Because I'm trying to rationalize this as an 8-year-old boy. Like what did I just witness exactly?
Yeah.
And he said, no, why do you ask? I said, well, I saw a little girl underneath the bed. And at first I thought that she snuck in, the family was out, out to lunch, out to dinner. And it was just the realtor, the doors open. Maybe a neighborhood kid snuck in there and hid. I was trying to ration, I had no frame of reference, obviously, and so I'm trying to figure out what's really going on. But that was an entity. It was not a child at all, right? It was a demonic entity that had lived in that house, and it haunted me. You know, it targeted me as a young man. It was terrifying. I mean, I would go out and hang out with my friends. I'd stay the night for a sleepover. And the same thing would happen to me. You know, I'd be there hanging out, sleeping, and all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, you'd hear it walk up the stairs and walk into the room.
Yeah.
Terrifying stuff, really.
Would your friends experience it, too, at all, when they were hanging out there?
No, they didn't. And even my family had a very minimal experience with the phenomenon. It wasn't until we actually moved out of the house that my father pulled me aside and he said, listen, I didn't really want to feed into your fear. He said, but whenever he was alone in the house, he felt like he was being watched, especially in the basement, you know. So something was there, be it consciousness, disincarnate consciousness, or something even more worse.
Yeah. I mean, so tell me, you said you kind of developed coping mechanisms to deal with this as a mm-hmm. child. What did you do to cope? What were the mechanisms?
So I started hypothesizing about it. What is it? Why is it targeting me? Mm-hmm. I slipped into a deep depression at that age because I wasn't sleeping.
Yeah.
Every night I would slip into a nightmare. It was the same nightmare. And what's so unique about it is, as an eight-year-old, I had no frame of reference for drug addiction. None, right? Nobody. No eight-year-old should, you know. Sure. They don't know anything. But in this nightmare, I was always like walking up to a shelter in a park. It was all in black and white. There were two young men sitting on a picnic table with their backs turned towards me. And the young man on the right had a needle in his arm, which, again, I'm a kid. Yeah. I had no idea what that was. So I'm looking, and then the young man on the left turns around, grins at me, pulls out a black 357 Magnum, puts it in his mouth, and pulls the trigger.
That's a great childhood dream.
Oh, yeah, I know, right?
Did you pick that up on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood on that one episode where Mr. McFeely comes for the delivery and offs himself on the porch?
Today, kids,
we're going to learn about postal suicide.
Absolutely. PTSD in another dimension.
Yes.
Yeah, so, and that was a repetitive dream. Every night I would slip into that nightmare, and then when I woke up, there would be such a heavy presence in the room, and that entity would, to me, to this day, it was almost parasitic, where it would feed on my fear.
Yeah.
And so one of my coping mechanisms was to hypothesize over and over again, why am I afraid of this entity? Am I afraid of this entity because I don't understand it? Is it projecting a manufactured fear upon me, right? And then I'm afraid of that. And that's how I coped with it. And it was literally, quite literally, a way of getting around the trauma of dealing with daily life, of going to school with it, waking up with it, taking a shower with it. And the older I became, the more I wanted to understand its pathology. Why me? Mm-hmm. And not just me, but why all the other eight-year-olds that are being haunted by the phenomenon?
Yeah.
Because I wasn't alone in it, you know what I mean?
Yeah. That is the question. Why you? I mean, and I guess my next question would be, obviously it's a very dark, you know, dream and dark imagery to be going through your mind mm-hmm. without having any real reason for it to be sparked that way. So that seems pretty dark, but why did you described that the little girl, you later realized you believed that she was an entity that was demonic and did take different forms. Tell me about how you kind of came to that conclusion. What other things occurred in that house that led you to go, this isn't a little girl. This isn't just, you know, some old man walking down the hall. This is demonic.
Right. Well, number one, the pervasive stench that was in the room. Later on in my research, I realized that even as far back in the late Iron Age, people smelled that same entity. They smelled that same sulfur scent. Mm-hmm. And they believed it was disincarnate consciousness. They believed that the ghost carried the same stench that comes from its corpse.
Okay.
Brilliant. Brilliant stuff. But, you know, the number one reason why I felt like that is because that manifestation of a little girl never occurred again. You know, if it's an actual haunting of a little girl, she'll come back. This entity was literally, quite literally, like looking to get consent from me, or looking to build relationship with me, looking for approval, or looking even to build trust. And once I realized, just after the initial open house, when I realized that that was an actual ghost or something other than a girl, the entity had no choice but to evolve. It had no choice but to mutate. I mean, you know, and it was a shadow figure. It mutated different ways. You know, I remember one night playing video games, and I saw movement out of the corner of my right eye, and I look, and outside of the window, during the wintertime, outside of the window, there is a shadow figure staring at me. And then he tilted its head. And this, here's what's wild, right? Because the paranormal is not supposed to break certain rules, but it does. The next morning, I remember walking outside of my house and seeing two footprints right outside of my window. And the window sill started at 7 feet. We got a problem here, right? Yeah. We got a significant issue here.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So that was the entity. That was the entity. It wasn't a little girl. It was, to me, in my mind, it was either an entity that causes suicide to occur, or it was somebody that committed it.
Okay.
And they were stuck. That's why I believe to this day, most of my cases, you know, I'm the most sensitive dealing with spirit of suicide. But whatever it was malevolent. And in my career to date, I'm only 34. But to this day, I mean, that was the most malevolent entity I've encountered. And I've had murder cases that were less demonic than what I encountered.
What do you think its ultimate goal was with you?
I don't know. The way it secluded me, the way it caused me to be withdrawn from my family, I think it was feeding on me, feeding on innocence, and triggering certain emotions within me, and like a parasite feeding off of it. So it was a deeply traumatic time of my life. I mean, I was, this is wild, man. I was staying up all night long, and because I didn't want to go to sleep. Whenever I would go to sleep, I would just enter into that nightmare, and then that entity would manifest in the room, and it was just horrific. And so I was staying up all night long, and then I would go to school and pass out at the desk. And my parents and my teachers, the principals, are all like, you know, they're like, what's going on? And my parents are like, look, you know, I don't know. He's just not, you know, he's not sleeping at night. You know, it was tough. But I think that the phenomenon itself targets different people because they're playing by their own rules. You know, they're cognizant of the maturity of an individual. And I think that they do have a measure of understanding of the future where, you know, if they can kill me now, they won't have to deal with me later. I think that's occurring throughout. It's occurred throughout history. It's still occurring where they'll try to eliminate people that they find a threat to them. So that's really what I'm thinking.
Okay. How interesting. When you weren't sleeping those nights and school is like, what's going on here? Are you telling your parents you're having this dream over and over? How are you expressing this?
Oh, well, my dad was working first shift. My mom was working at a daycare center. And so imagine a 9-10-year-old kid dragging a mattress in your room every night and waking you up.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it was.
Okay.
And even in their room, I'm telling you, man, even in their room, I could still feel, I felt safe, but I still felt like I was being watched by something. It was a thick energy. It was a dark energy that would literally suffocate you in its presence. But you know, there were times when I'd wake my dad up, and finally, you know, they were working so hard, barely making, you know, the bills on time. And a lot of nights I spent crying by myself. Just be real with you. You know, what is this? I don't understand it. Why me?
Sure.
And I think, you know, I went to a church too, and the church really had no answers for me either, mm-hmm. which only compounded the issue. Right? They didn't know shadow figures existed, and I have one in my room, or I have one looking at me. So none of what I was, this is another whole other show, brother, but what I was experiencing did not fit the blueprint of evangelical modernity.
Sure.
And so as a child, I'm going to them for answers, and I'm getting more questions. Mm-hmm. And then I'm having to go home and deal with this entity that whether I wanted to believe it or not, it was present.
Yeah.
It wasn't going away just because I didn't have an answer.
Is your family thinking, like, is there something psychologically going on? Or did they know that, no, he's in fact, he's experiencing these things, and this is this is ghostly. It's not like a mental health condition or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in antiquity, we call it a ghost-borne illness, which is fascinating. Now, my parents, they had their own hypothesis, you know. I never went to a therapist or anything, but the entity was slowly grooming me for suicide.
Yeah.
Literally, it's wild, man. I would get in trouble at school and I wouldn't write sentences at all. And then I would start writing suicide poetry.
Mm-hmm.
No understanding of what's happening. And so, you know, it was a spiritual warfare, war. It was a spiritual battle going on for me and my future. And I think it had to happen to me to get me to where I am right now in my field and my research. You know, that's why I'm here. We're still looking for answers because the phenomenon is still affecting 8-year-olds,
yeah,
especially young women who are going into their womanhood. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's where I began. That's what ushered me into this research. And what I learned at an early age is they're playing by different rules because they're playing a different game.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think Christianity, especially Catholicism, has dominated demonology for millennia.
Sure.
Right. But we also have different traditions that have different teachings. Mm-hmm. And I think that once, especially in the paranormal field, I think we need to start bleeding our consciousness into those understandings and break ourselves out of the dogmatism that's killing the field. These are not all fallen angels. And if they are, what is a fallen angel? Right.
Well,
what are they?
And my question is always, you know, if these things are as powerful as, you know, what people are reporting, the hell that they're putting people through, why would they have to listen to you say, you know, leave me alone, or in the name of this deity, you have to go. Why? And if every religion's going to have a different dogma that they're going to, you know, preach and apply to these situations, wouldn't that entity have to be playing by those specific rules that are trying to be imposed? I've always been mm-hmm. confused by that. But then I always kind of get back to people saying, well, it's the intent at the end of the day. So, yeah.
No.
That's a
nice mantra that people throw around at Paracons.
Yeah.
It's your intent. It's not. Okay. I've done hundreds of shows. I'm a grassroots researcher. I work with abductees, experiencers, malevolent hauntings. No, absolutely not. They're playing by different rules here. Even if you get into the data, we have cases of people who call on the name of Jesus and their eyes roll back in their head.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have to look at what roles they're playing, right?
Yeah.
Why are they wanting us to believe in certain dogmas and disbelieve in others? And again, I think it's boiled down to this. It's not intent. It's not intent, because even with Ouija boards, I'm intending to contact Ted, my Uncle Ted, right? And mm-hmm. Ted Kuklinski or whatever comes through. It's not Ted. It doesn't matter what your intention is,
mm-hmm.
right? So these beings, again, it seems like they're feeding us little bits of information and hiding themselves in the darkness of ignorance. We, you know, that's where I'm at in my research. But I think that the field is bigger. It's larger. Hauntology and ufology, they're the same phenomenon with different masks. And we can get a case studies too, man. But that's where I'm at with it. And we have to think like they think. We have to look at their pathology and their victimology throughout history, whether it be UFOs or aliens or demons or angels. They've never changed their pathology. They've just changed the terms that we call them. So we're looking at the same phenomenon throughout history.
So what kind of rules are they playing by?
According to my data, we're looking at least at high magic. I had a case of mine. Dude, this is fascinating. I was doing a lecture one night on scarifications with incubi cases and how Father Sinistrari of Amino was doing autopsies on victims of incubi and succubi. And these beings were carving symbols underneath their eyelids. Incredible stuff, man. Well, this gentleman reached out to me and he said, I need to talk to you about my father. He's dead now, he says, but some of your research kind of resonates with me. So we're getting on the phone and everything, and he talks to me and he says, my father was a famous remote viewer. And he said, my dad would leave his body. He would meet his quote unquote guides, and his guides would give him information. And then he would get back into his body and he would call a famous local celebrity or a local politician and say, listen, you know, this is what's going to happen in your future and all that. And he said, well, he said, my dad was making thousands of dollars doing this. He was very accurate in his prophecies. And he said, well, one night, he said, I was playing video games downstairs, and his dad stumbles down the stairs, incoherent, white as a ghost, shaking and crying. And he said his dad had a massive coronary. He had a heart attack. He said, and as they were taking him into the hospital room, they were taking his shirt off and putting his robe on. And he said, as they're looking at his body subdermally, now everybody, those who are going to listen to this, we have to contemplate this and comprehend this because it's unbelievable. But subdermally, underneath the skin, religious amulets pushed their way up to the surface, to the exterior of his chest. These were underneath the skin first and moved their way to the surface of his body. These were interreligious, cross-cultural amulets. The first one was the Star of David. The second one was the cross. The third one was Egyptian hieroglyphics. This is disturbing.
This is coming. Why? This is being pushed through from the inside. This, okay.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. The same phenomenon. Again, there's a skull, there's a soul to the skin connection here.
Yeah.
The same phenomenon occurs in hauntology. I've had cases where women, specifically, they feel a burning sensation, just like this gentleman did. And from underneath the skin, scratches emerge to the surface. Just like Ian Stevenson's work with the afterlife, people who had a death wound have birthmarks, right? Mm-hmm. Their past life, there was a death wound. It mortally wounded them, they died. And now today in this body, it's a birthmark. Mm-hmm. But my main point here is that these beings were carving religious amulets into this man's chest. And demonology is groping in the darkness to even understand these amulets. Number one, we have people in the paranormal field that are so closed-minded that, you know, a Catholic priest is not going to go out there and use the Star of David against a demon. Mm-hmm. You follow my logic here?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they don't believe in it. But then vice versa, you're not going to have a rabbi using the cross. And you certainly are not going to have anybody using Egyptian hieroglyphics against these entities. Mm-hmm. However, they're using them against us as a group, almost as a mathematical equation. The closest rendition of these scarifications that we're finding on bodies come out of Eliphas Levi's work and Abraham the Mage. They encountered this kind of this issue of scarification on bodies, and they called it angel magic. So whatever we're dealing with, it transcends the microcosm. I'm going to give a 5-minute speech on, you know, the Paracon, and that's going to sum up a phenomenon. And I say it with all respect. They're far darker, they're far deeper, and they're using laws that we're not even aware of against us.
That's very frightening. I mean, to think, because it kind of throws everything that you think you know about these things and these the behaviors, and, you know, gives you far more questions than answers, as this stuff always does. But it makes you then wonder, okay, well, what are the rules? Where are these things coming from? Are these things literally coming from a heaven or a hell, as we would, as you know, dogma in, you know, Catholicism or Christianity would, you know, profess to be, this is what it is? Or is this something, you know, much deeper, more elemental of the world, and just our beings, where it's just negativity and there's good? What are you believing we're dealing with here, through your research?
Well, I'm going to refer to the Atreus epic. It's the Babylonian flood myth. This is what it is. This is powerful stuff, man. Powerful stuff. It says that the ghost of a man is made from the flesh of a god. Think about that. Mm-hmm. Consciousness. This aspect of the soul and the disincarnate version of us, that everyone possesses, the human potentiality to outgrow and molt the skin of flesh and bone and become something that's liminal, right? It's literally in between two worlds. That's what I think we're dealing with. I don't think we're dealing with aliens. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we're dealing with demons. I think we're dealing, again, if we go throughout history and look at the bloody footprints in the snow, no, we were always dealing with disincarnate entities who are looking to possess a new body. And that's what they've always wanted to do. And so I found their pathology and their behavioral patterns thousands of years back. And so, but again, your question, and it's one of my favorite questions too, is what are the rules they're playing by? Because they're definitely playing by rules. But what's happened now is the field is so compartmentalized that what's happened is so fascinating. We can have victims of UFO abduction, but they'll never talk to a victim of an incubi or an incubus. Because mm-hmm. those are two different fields, we were told. No, they're the same entities. And they're wanting us to be compartmentalized. They're wanting us to just kind of set ourselves in a corner and never allow these two individuals to share their stories. Mm-hmm. Because what we'll see is that it's the same phenomenon. It's just they're wanting us to believe they're different entities. That's really where I'm at. But I believe 100% that these are a version of the ghost god, that tangible consciousness that molds the body, and it almost devolves just as much as it evolves. I tell people in my lectures, it's a lot like when somebody steps out of a room, right? And then they go back into the room and they use everything they learned outside of that room against us. That's what we're dealing with. Whatever and whoever they are, I believe 100% that they are in the version of afterlife, a version of it, where they've molted skin and bones. And now they're learning things that we're ignorant of to this day.
When you said earlier that they're seeking out people, you know, bodies essentially to possess, how often do you think it is that they're succeeding at that and people are mm-hmm. completely unaware that there's anything of the sort going on, that they're even possessed, that... Especially, I guess I go to this with the true crime, and I do a show on that too. And just the utter amount of just vile, horrible things of humans do to others. And obviously humans have been doing this for years. But is there more of this going on where people are literally becoming possessed by something and something is taking over them? And in some cases, driving them to do the horrific things that we're seeing?
100%. And it is an act of self-replication. Let's call it what it is. It's self-replication and self-preservation. One thing that I've looked at, so I'm fascinated with true crime too. Mm-hmm. You know, get me a six pack and I'll get me a serial killer documentary, man. I'm into the pathology there and want to understand their psychology more. But let's look at Jeffrey Dahmer. Jeffrey Dahmer, his only living victim was drugged, or he tried to drug the man. The man went into the bathroom, and he said when he came out into the living room, he looked at Jeffrey Dahmer watching his favorite movie, The Exorcist, mm-hmm. Swaying back and forth and speaking in a language, another language, speaking in tongues. So what we're looking for, is, especially in my research, I'm looking for what I call memory in motion. Mm-hmm. When a person, that's what possession is, when consciousness invades the body, and now that individual, especially throughout history, they have shared memories of that consciousness, where, you know, I, for some reason, I'm remembering being in Prague, but I've never stepped foot in Prague, right? And so when that consciousness invades the body, you're not just dealing with memories that are separate from the individual's experience, you're dealing with belief systems and knowledge that individual shouldn't have, like mm-hmm. Jeffrey Dahmer. He liked to pulverize the bones of his victims and go out in his backyard and throw the powder out in a circular motion. That's a ritual. Mm-hmm. But how did he know that?
Yeah.
See, right? That entity is looking through his eyes. It stretched itself into their skin, and it's hunting men, soul hunters, harvesting consciousness from their victims. And I think that's occurring a lot of times. But again, if we're looking at the role of possession, this is interesting. Possession is pregnancy to them.
Okay.
In the 16th century, we have a very strange phenomenon that occurred in Safdie. It's a province in Israel. And you're going to notice hints of the missing fetus syndrome in this case study. Women were being accosted by entities in their dreams. The next day, they're possessed by the entity that assaulted them. And then the next day after that, they realize that they're not only possessed by the consciousness of the entity, they're impregnated by it.
Like literally, and Rosemary's Baby literally, and such?
Literally.
Wow.
Yes, sir. This gets very deep and dark quickly.
Yeah.
Put a seatbelt on. We're diving in. So then, according to the Kabbalistic text, they were presenting themselves to the Kabbalistic exorcists, Haim Mattal, Isaac Luria, and these physicians were performing what's called the levush in Hebrew, where they would take their wrists and they would press on their wrists and they would feel two pulses in one body. Hello, missing fetus syndrome. All right. Hello, incubi, inseminating women with fetus. They would feel two heartbeats in the woman. And so just like in the sexual pathology and victimology of the missing fetus syndrome, 4 months later, the baby's missing. It's gone. The woman's no longer pregnant. However, she was no longer possessed either. Uh-huh. And so the consciousness that was in her literally possessed the fetus. Then when these beings took the fetus out with it, so did the consciousness leave. So this is what we're dealing with. Some supremely superior species here.
Like when the fetus is missing, does she have a miscarriage, or is it literally just gone?
It's gone. I have cases like that myself, right? I mean, it's stretching its draconian shadow from history to modernity. They're still doing this. They're doing it with impunity.
Tell me about today, what you've seen where this sort of thing is occurring.
Well, see, I think that history is looking at the same phenomenon through different lenses. Prior to us identifying these things as alien, we called them incubi, it's succubi. And then even deeper, we called the fetus that is impregnated and placed in the womb, we called that larva an early form of life. When you get into Jewish mythology, they called it a golem.
Okay.
In the first mention of the golem in the Hebrew text, it's in Genesis when it refers to Adam. He's the beginning of life. So that's what we're dealing with. But right now, we have women all across the world that are being assaulted by these entities. And it's not a good thing. It's not like people become fairy godmothers, okay? No, it is absolutely an assault. And so my own cases, I've worked with marriages that are falling apart because of these beings, where one lady called me from the side of a road after she heard one of my lectures, and she started crying. She goes, "I got to talk to you about something." I said, "Okay." She said that she started being taken at a young age of like 12, as soon as she hit puberty, right? This is fascinating because these beings monitor the fertility of women. And so they were monitoring her fertility and her puberty, and they started taking her at a young age and using her as a breeder. We've got to tell it what it is, like it is, call it what it is. They were using this woman as a breeder. And she said that recently she had a hysterectomy. And she said one night, these beings, again, they monitor fertility. They went into her room and they started examining her body like they've done since she was a child. And they realized that she was no longer able to replicate their species. And she said, finally, they left me alone. And so what we're looking at, again, it is a self-replication program. They're using the mortal portal of wounds and words to step into this dimension, and we don't know how to stop it.
So
that's the scariest.
When you're saying a breeder, are you saying that like the woman actually comes to term with a child, has a child, or is this where it disappears?
Both occur.
Okay.
Dr. Carla Turner had a case study where the baby itself, I don't know if they forgot to take it or what, but the woman started having complications with it. And now we're talking about possession. This is fascinating. This is how dark it gets. But she actually miscarried the child, and in the bathroom, it fell out into her arms. It had bulbous eyes, and it was humanoid. And so Dr. Carla Turner said, "Well, where is this baby? Where is the fetus at? Where's, you know?" She said, "I don't know." She said, "Something possessed me to bury it in a glass jar." And then she said, and when I, she went into a trance and said, "You know, and I don't know where it's at. I just know that I buried it." So this gets into something deeper about the missing twin syndrome. And I don't want to ramble, man.
No,
So
you're
just
fine.
let me know.
No, we're good.
The missing twin syndrome, okay, it's another aspect of the missing fetus syndrome where they will inseminate a woman or they'll take seed from a man and they'll inseminate a woman, create a hybrid or a fetus in the womb, and then pluck it out of her. We have case studies of women who they've never been with a man. I'm getting passionate, don't you? They've never even been with a man. And then they go in for like gynecological surgery. And the gynecologist and the surgeon look at them and say, "Listen, you have some fetal tissue. You have scar tissue from giving birth. What's going on here?" And so, even deeper than that, and this is a hypothesis that I've been working on, and I'm going to talk about it on my show tomorrow, the missing twin syndrome. Did you know? Obviously, they're monitoring fertility, but did you know that if a woman is intimate with two different men in the same cycle, that she can have twins in her body? And both babies, one will belong to another man and the other to another man. So look at the missing twin syndrome. I'm not talking about one twin eating the other or, you know, combining DNA. No, I'm literally talking about women who will go in and say, "Listen, I knew I had twins last week. I felt something going on gynecologically or internally, and that twin's completely gone." What this means to me is that not only are they monitoring fertility, they know which baby belongs to them,
But
and they're taking it.
where does it go is the question physically, you know, because if you're going, you're being monitored, you're getting you know, all sorts of things looking inside of you and you see two babies. What happens when this occurs and it's just gone physically? Where does it go? That wraps up the first part of our conversation with Nathaniel in part two. What kind of cases has Nathaniel investigated that truly have shocked him? Is it possible for a demonic entity to impregnate a woman in a paranormal assault? Yes, very Rosemary's Baby. And why does Nathaniel believe that some demonic entities seek out young women? Until next time, for all of us at The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. the unintended consequences of these programs. They had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.